Welcome to episode 7 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So, this episode, we're travelling into your confessions now.
We are, and we should explain to the filmmaker film watcher virgins out there, which is a concept I don't want to think about, is that we talk about our confessions as films that, as professional film reviewers, we should have seen by
really
now and just haven't. And for those who are more long-term devotees of our podcast might remember how shocked I was, and anyone I speak to since, from season one, that you had never seen The Sound of Music.
That's right. Yeah, was it?
Which is quite a confession. And so it's the same concept. And so if you tuned in last time, folks, Ricardo was in the confessional and we looked at three films he'd never seen before, which were Galaxy Quest, and we had a bit of a dispute about you not liking that enough as far as I was concerned.
That's right.
12 Angry Men from the 50s with Henry Fonda.
Classic, yeah.
And Dolores Claiborne, the Stephen King novel turned into a film
That's
with
right.
Kathy Bates.
Yeah, which I'd read the book, yeah, but never seen the movie.
So we decided that Turnabout is fair play, and I should now reveal what are probably at least two cases more shocking revelations of films I've never seen.
Okay, you can say what you like about me not seeing Sound of Music, but Greg...
Hang on a minute.
But Greg has never seen, and this is what the films we're going to be talking about on this episode, is 1990's Pretty Woman, you'd never seen, 1946's Great Expectations.
Yeah, but you hadn't seen it either.
Yeah, okay, but
that's not that big a confession.
It's not that big about it, but is it? Yeah, but still.
But the first and third ones, yeah, okay, I'll grant you.
1976, Rocky. He'd never seen Rocky.
Now, if you walk into a room of mixed demographics and said, hands up all those who haven't seen Rocky, you might get a few people of my demographic, maybe more women who hadn't seen it. Pretty Woman, maybe the sex is reverse. If you walked into a room and said, who hasn't seen Sound of Music? I reckon you'd be one of the only ones standing up.
I don't know, actually. I don't know.
So, what do you think? Go to our Facebook page and... Okay. So, why don't we step into my confessional? I can say something like, you know, bless me, Ricardo, for I have sinned, for I have been watching crap. And talk about this golden classic. Start us off with 1990's Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman, the mega hit Cinderella story to kick off the 90s. Directed by Gary Marshall, who also directed, you know, other romance films, Frankie and Johnny, Runaway Bride, The Princess Diaries series, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, New Year's Eve, lots of romance comedies. Pretty Woman, however, would have to be the best of them. The story is relatively simple. Vivian Ward, Julia Roberts in the role that made her, is a prostitute who lucks in on a wealthy businessman client, Edward, Richard Gere, who's in town trying to close a deal. He makes his living buying and breaking up companies. He seems quite lonely and is also a little smitten by Vivian, so asks her to spend the week with him for $3,000. He buys her new clothes, takes her to dinner, and they begin to fall for one another. She is still a prostitute, however, so that does test their relationship when his business partner, Philip, Jason Alexander, gets wind of this information. Philip is also not happy that Edward is beginning to change his mind on the deal they've been working on and blames Vivian for this. Once they overcome these significant hurdles, they bridge the gap between their very different worlds. Look, this is such a lovely, cute, sweet film. It really hasn't dated much other than the obvious technology advances. Richard Gere and Julia Roberts are at the peak of their powers here. Special mention to Laura Sangiacomo as Vivian's best friend Kit as well. Julia Roberts was last in line for this role because she was new and didn't have that many credits to her name, but everyone else who was up for the role either had schedule conflicts or they just simply turned it down. Gere himself turned down the role until Gary Marshall flew Julia Roberts to meet him personally. And while, yes, it's sometimes hard to really believe Vivian's character is actually a prostitute, really, Edward and her are just great together. This is a fairy tale. I was 12 when this film came out and remember how much of a massive hit it was. And it wasn't just the movie. The soundtrack was in everyone's house, with songs from Prince, Go West, Red Hot Chili Peppers, David Bowie, Roxette, Aha, Fine Young Cannibals, and obviously Roy Orbison with the title song Pretty Woman. It was huge. Apparently, however, this film was originally written to be quite darker. Before Disney stepped in, with Vivian being a drug addict, Kit dying of a drug overdose, and Edward throwing Vivian out of the car with the $3,000, which was the original title for the film. Thank goodness that didn't go this way. And I was thinking that Hank Azaria's fleeting detective cop character may have been an offcut of that darker story, but maybe not. But look, this is just an enjoyable, now classic romance that just makes you feel good. Greg, did you like it?
Really sorry to tell you this, Ricardo, but you were wrong from your opening sentence. And this film is constantly referred to as a Cinderella story, and it's not.
It is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
It's a different story, but it's not Cinderella. It's My Fair Lady.
Now, okay.
Let me point out to you why I think it is.
Yes.
I think it's both in terms of the story and also some clues in the film itself. Mm. And this might be me way over-interpreting, but hey, that's what I'm here for.
Okay, I can see the Pygmalion reference here.
Well, Cinderella is that, you know, she's basically, you know, the urchin housemaid.
Mm.
She meets the prince by going to his big party.
That's right.
And then he goes out looking for her, trying to find her amongst, you know, the women of the kingdom, and they get married, live happily ever after. It's only Cinderella in terms of rags and riches, but this is Pygmalion, My Fair Lady.
Yeah, yeah.
So he is the, you know, the man from the upper class with wealth and so on that he doesn't particularly care about either way. He finds a woman from the undesirable classes. In My Fair Lady, it's the lower class flower maid. Here it's the prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
They encounter each other. He is charmed by her intellect and presence, personality.
Yep.
He, despite himself, falls in love with her, and he transforms her as part of that by buying her nice clothes and teaching her. She gets taught manners, in this case, by the hotel manager.
Yes, that's right.
So the story-wise, it's absolutely My Fair Lady. We've had the songs.
Yeah, you're actually right.
But there are two clues, and I reckon these are probably deliberate. At one stage, the Julie Roberts character, Vivian, is watching a TV. And on the TV is a scene from Charade, which you and I think covered
in season one.
That's
right, we did, yes.
Which is Audrey Hepburn.
Yes.
And Audrey Hepburn, of course, was Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady.
That's right.
And the man whose business Richard Gere's trying to buy, Ralph Bellamy, in his final film ever.
Yes, right.
His grandson, who is grooming to take over his business. Do you know who that actor is?
No.
That's Alec Hyde-White. And I know who he is because years ago I saw him in a time-travelling Biggle Stories of all things. And I really liked him, so I know his face.
Yeah, right.
Alec Hyde-White is the son of Wilfred Hyde-White, who played Colonel Pickering in My Fair Lady.
Oh, wow.
I think that's too much.
There's a lot of references there. Wow.
Well, there's two.
Yeah, yeah.
I only realised this towards the end, and I'd like to go back and watch it one day to see if anywhere, I don't think they did, but to see if anywhere they mentioned the 20th of May. Because in My Fair Lady, when she's singing the song where she's so upset with Henry Higgins and she imagines the king making her the cream of society, the song says, "Next week on the 20th of May, I proclaim Liza Doolittle Day."
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a reference there to 20th of May, I reckon that's signed, sealed, delivered. But I think it's My Fair Lady.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's actually more My Fair Lady. But it's always been talked about as a Cinderella story.
I know.
Yeah.
And I think it's the marketing department.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the director, writer, and so on.
Well, I think, you know, saying it's a Cinderella story, but other than a My Fair Lady story, it's, yeah.
And,
or Pygmalion.
But I haven't answered your question, did I like it?
Did you like it?
I did. I didn't love it, but I liked it. I found it quite slow at times. I thought she was very good. I worked it out. She was only about 22, 23.
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
She made this on the back of Steel Magnolias, which I like. And I don't know if it had been released at that point. So she was an up-and-comer, but not well-known.
No.
And the other reason you didn't mention about why a number of actresses turned it down, they weren't sure about playing a prostitute.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Whereas for Julie Roberts at that stage in her career, this is a big break.
Yeah, that's right.
And as you say, it went, you know...
It was a mega hit.
Yeah, nuclear. You know,
it did.
In terms of soundtrack and film, as you do rightly say. So it's nice to know you got that bit right. That's me just being so patronising. So I liked it, and I liked the story. I thought hers was a very winning performance. Again, like you, don't quite believe her as a prostitute.
No, but it's a fairy tale.
Her friend Kit was...
Was more of a prostitute. Yeah, that's
apparently
right.
they shifted some of the darker elements of Vivian's story onto Kit.
Right.
And they kind of contextualised it. They told this backstory. She told him in bed one night, this backstory that she had come to the Big Smoke to be something else and it hadn't worked out and she'd been trying this other thing.
Yes, yeah. It's not believable, okay, but it is a fairy tale.
Yeah,
but
it's certainly a fairy tale.
Look, but Julia Roberts is so sweet in this. So easy to watch. She's delightful, really. It's interesting. There's one scene where she's watching Lucille Ball.
Yep.
And apparently she was finding it hard to really laugh well.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Gary Marshall apparently was tickling her feet.
Off camera.
Off camera while she was watching that. And the thing is, I quite think that she's laughing quite over the top at that scene. Because I'm like, she's watching a black and white Lucille Ball.
That's a very famous scene of Lucille Ball. Vita Vegem, something.
It's not that funny. Like, I just didn't find you. She's absolutely cacking herself. It's like she's just discovered television and discovered there's moving people in a television.
But it makes sense in the story because you can see Richard Gere is really taken by the fact that she's responding in that way.
Yeah, that's right. But I was just a little bit too much. But he's wonderful too.
Yeah. Sorry, I want to go back to My Fair Lady. I forgot the third clue, and it's a biggie. They echo a scene from My Fair Lady. So when they go to watch the polo... Mm-hmm. And she absolutely cheers that horse on.
That's right.
In a way that the others are all kind of laid back. That's Ascot Gavotte from My Fair Lady when she's going, you know, come on, Dover, move your bloody ass.
That's right, yes.
And so I think, in fact, that's the bit that really seals it for me. That's an absolute reference to My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
One of the things that didn't date was that when she stops being a prostitute and she starts, you know, changing her lifestyle a la the film's, you know, plot line. Her clothes are fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
The red dress, which was quite iconic, that looks a little dated. 1990, it looks a bit late 80s, early 90s.
It does, but it's still really lovely and elegant.
Oh, yeah.
Some
of the ruffles, yeah, the details
are
a bit dated. But it's a stunning colour on her. It looked fantastic.
It is.
The brown with white spots thing she wears, the polo.
It's fantastic.
Hasn't dated.
No, it hasn't. It's really lovely. I love that whole bit. That's a really iconic scene too when she's got the diamond or the necklace, which is...
Of the hearts.
He sort of flicks it down and she laughs. And that's a real laugh.
It was impromptu.
It was impromptu, yeah. And that's so iconic now. Like, it's just really... You see that scene, you see her laugh. That is real, you know. And that's... I think those little special moments in there make the film.
I have to say, Jason Alexander... I struggle with a bit. So he made this before Seinfeld, didn't he?
Yeah.
So seeing him as the kind of the toadying friend I got, the attempted rape scene,
yes,
he wasn't convincing.
Yeah.
But who I did love in this was Hector Elizondo.
He's wonderful.
As the hotel manager.
Oh, he's so good.
He's so warm. He's understated.
He is.
And you can see that he's developing a real soft spot for her.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the interesting features of this story is that it's the people who are the everyday people. It's the hotel staff, for example, who once they get past her outfit and wig on the first day, you know, where she's very much the vamp kind of character.
That's right, yeah.
When she becomes herself, they all just warm to her. You know, the lift boy, bellhop.
Yes. He's another one. And just
Elizondo,
an expression, the expressions, yeah.
The women behind the reception when she first comes in are kind of, you know, looking at her all snooty, but then they become big fans of hers.
Yeah.
And that's a nice shift as well.
It is.
But it says that it's those people who are the real people, not the ones who are kind of up themselves in money and society, who recognise, with the exception of Richard Gere, recognise her true value. They kind of go on a mini version of his journey.
Yeah,
with regard
to
her.
That's right.
So I find this film slow, and that's my main critique of it.
You said that earlier, and I kind of disagree. I don't know which parts you...
The early parts, I felt like it took a long time to get going. In fact, of all three films in this episode... Great Expectations got right into the action. It was really good.
Yeah, it did.
Both Pretty Woman and Rocky, I found slow. Rocky particularly in the early parts, but this one I felt it as well.
I don't find it slow at all.
Yeah.
No, I actually don't. I mean, it takes a little while for them to meet, but I think that's needed because you really...
But it hits the 20-minute mark, I think. You know, that thing
about...
Yeah,
it does. Yeah, it does. That's the first act turning point. Yeah, it does.
Oh, I just remember thinking, I hope this picks up, and it did, but I wasn't grabbed from the outset.
No, right. Okay.
But I do recognise, you know, the place that this film plays, if you like, in film history. This and When Harry Met Sally really got rom-coms back to the, you know, the top of the slate again. They'd languished for a long time.
It did. And, I mean, look, it's No When Harry Met Sally. That is clever and just so classic. And that was only a year before. I think it was 89. I think it was When Harry Met Sally. So it wasn't that much earlier. Gary Marshall as a director, look...
I haven't seen a lot of his films or loved them. Like I saw The Runaway Bride, I enjoyed it, but yep. no great shakes.
But this is the thing. Gary Marshall's not one of those directors where if you didn't know who directed it, you wouldn't know it was Gary Marshall. There's no sort of real Gary Marshall stamp style, yeah. and style in his movies and the way they are sort of that are filmically made, but he makes enjoyable films. So I love The Princess Diaries.
I haven't seen them.
They're really good. They're really good. And you know... Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, they're just serviceable films that are enjoyable.
They're Hollywood Factory kind of films.
They are, but they're enjoyable. Like, he makes an enjoyable film. Though I haven't seen his R-rated Exit to Eden. I haven't watched that yet, but apparently it's quite terrible.
Yeah, I can't say I'm called to it.
No.
But, you know, I guess part of his style, if anything, is that, you know, he is also, as well as being a writer, producer, director, he's an actor. And so I suspect he's probably an actor's director.
Yes, right. Yeah. But look, Greg, what are you going to give this?
I'm giving it a 7.
Okay.
Because I say I didn't love it. And I do love Julia Roberts in, for example, My Best Friend's Wedding. I love that film.
I actually like her in a lot
and
of
that's,
things.
And that sparkles. That film really sparkles for me. This film I enjoy, but it didn't sparkle. Oh. And because I felt that slowness early on, I didn't feel like it dated. I mean, yes, the technology, as you say, when you sort of look back, but I didn't feel like it had dated, and I enjoyed it, but I don't know if I'll watch it again.
Oh, look.
Whereas I will watch My Best Friend's Wedding. I have, you know, a few times.
I've watched Pretty Woman quite a few times now, and I enjoy it every time. And the thing is, it just works on so many levels in that sort of a, you know, and makes you just feel good. I'm giving it an 8 because I just think it did, as you say,
reboot
the romance comedy and the romance, and so any film which does that. But I just think they're both great in it, and it's something you can just turn on and just watch and just enjoy.
Well, my wife was looking forward to watching this with me because she had seen it,
yeah.
and knew that I hadn't,
yeah.
And you know, she doesn't always like our choices of podcast films, but she was looking forward to this. But at the end, she kind of felt the same way. It hadn't sparkled for her either.
Wow.
But I want to tell you just before we move on to our next film. I want to tell you that I have discovered that these three films have something in common beyond the fact that I hadn't seen them before.
What is that?
They, and this is not necessarily unusual for films, but they have all been turned into stage musicals.
Oh, wow. All three of them. Right.
And so I want to tell you each time the names of some of the songs from their soundtrack. And I want to tell you, I'm working up to Rocky.
Yes.
But, Pretty Woman the Musical 2018 features such songs as Welcome to Hollywood and Welcome to Our World, More Champagne. Now, they're a bit ordinary. It gets better as we go along, but I'm just kind of laying the groundwork at the stage.
Look, you know what? And we'll get to Rocky soon, but you know, I never wanted to see the musical version of it. I don't know how that would have worked, but we'll get there. So the next film we're going to discuss is 1946's Great Expectations.
Charles Dickens' 1860 novel has been filmed 14 times, with another TV series currently in development, and has heavily influenced at least two other feature films. It tells the story of young orphan Pip, Anthony Wager, from a lowly background, destined to follow his brother-in-law Joe as the local blacksmith. But Pip develops great expectations. He aspires to love beautiful but disdainful Estella, Jean Simmons, in her first film role, the ward of healthy Miss Havisham, Martita Hunt, who has plans for Estella but don't include Pip. As a young man, Pip, now played by John Mills, is suddenly gifted with a mysterious benefactor, providing the means for Pip to become a London gentleman, and assumes that he's been favoured by Miss Havisham to become worthy of the adult Estella, Valerie Hobson. Pip moves to London to share rooms with the wide-eyed Herbert Pocket, Alec Guinness, learning etiquette and the arts of dance, fencing and debt accrual. He equally learns to become ashamed of his rural background and family. Gentleman Pip eventually discovers the unexpected source of his income and how this is interwoven with Estella's own background. This 1946 film was the third version of Dickens' novel, preceded by a now-lost 50-minute silent film from 1917 and an expensive failure by Universal Studios in 1934. You can see why it's been filmed so often. It has a highly atmospheric opening where Child Pip is threatened by an escaped convict in a lonely churchyard on the moors, and it provides one of the most memorable characters in modern literature, Miss Havisham, the abandoned bride driven mad by a broken heart, forever clad in her wedding gown and surrounded by her rotting wedding banquet and plotting her revenge on men. Director David Lean knows how to make the most of Dickens' theatricality through the visual power of black and white film. The misty churchyard is suitably creepy in the opening, where young Pip has to run past gallows that prefigure events in his later life. And Miss Havisham's shut-in house is majestic, a masterclass in the use of light and shadow. For me, there are other standout visual moments. Shadows on the Smithies Forge when London lawyer Mr. Jaggers arrives with news of Pip's good fortune. The hangman's noose and death masks from less successful clients that decorate the walls of Mr. Jagger's office. The dramatic appearance of Pip's benefactor in his doorway on a dark and stormy night, and a white flickering to signify when a stressed-out Pip is succumbing to illness. I loved these moments, as well as some of the performances, particularly Bernard Miles as Joe the earnest blacksmith, with hat-juggling skills and weirdly bushy eyebrows. Finlay Curry is good as the convict, Magwitch, as is Martita Hunt as Miss Havisham, a role she played on stage in Alec Guinness's 1939 production. And it's interesting to note that Frances L. Sullivan, who plays the role of Jaggers here, played the same part in the earlier 1934 version. But I didn't love the film overall. Despite the arresting visuals, I found the film episodic rather than roundly engaging, and I missed some of Dickens' plot reveals. The 32-year-old John Mills looked too old to play 20-year-old Pip despite his best efforts, and its ending was far too Hollywood. Now, I may well be in a minority here. Great Expectations is regarded as one of Lean's best films. It was named as the fifth greatest British film by the British Film Institute in 1999, preceded by Carol Reed's The Third Man, Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, and Lean's own Brief Encounter, which I haven't actually seen, and Lawrence of Arabia. Now, Ricardo, I know that Lean's Dr. Zhivago is one of your all-time favourite films. We reviewed it a year or two ago.
Yeah.
But you've not previously seen this film. So were your expectations greatly met?
You know, I actually was a bit confused because I thought I had seen it, but I was actually confused with Lean's Oliver Twist.
Yep.
And I loved that Oliver Twist. I think that was such a brilliant portrayal of that story. This one, I'm like you, I appreciated it technically. I appreciated David Lean's directorial craft. He really is a master storyteller and really ahead of his time. I mean, some of the shots in there and how he can show traveling time, mood, he does it so well. It almost hasn't dated because of that. You know, his filmmaking style is ahead of its time, I think. But again, I actually thought that I think Brief Encounter is a better film.
I was thinking as I watched Great Expectations that maybe that should have been the choice for me because Brief Encounter is one of those films. Oliver Twist, a lot of people haven't seen it.
Yes.
And maybe younger people haven't seen Brief Encounter, but it's a very, very well-known film.
It is.
And I haven't seen it.
It is better. And I think the Oliver Twist is better. But I also think that, you know, Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia are better also.
Well, you know that I didn't love Zhivago.
Zhivago, that's right.
I have seen Lawrence of Arabia and I like it. I think it's a fine film.
It is a fine film. Whereas this is not a bad film by any stretch. And the thing is, I really like the story of Great Expectations. I'd actually seen the Alfonso Cuarón one with a version with Ethan Hawke and...
Oh, the Gwyneth Paltrow one.
And the thing is, when I watched that, because I love this, I like the story... And I really loved that film, actually. I thought that was a really good telling of the story. And actually, I really noticed when I saw that...
And that was a modern update, wasn't
it? That was a modern update, yeah. But I really noticed Alfonso Cuarón's style in that. It was just... It was oozing style, that film. And I thought, it actually made me go, oh, who directed this? Because it was just... And now he's gone on to do so much. He did Gravity. He did, you know... He did a Harry Potter. He's done a lot of things, anyway. But I was kind of liking it, but then sort of a bit tired by it. I was a little bit bored sometimes.
Yep.
The story's better than what that was portraying to me.
And I think that's...
Did you feel like that?
Well, yeah. I said in my intro that I felt like they'd cut out some really vital plot points from Dickens. So, and for me, the big one is... So there was the second convict who escaped at the start when Magwitch did.
Yes.
And in the novel, I read the novel at school and I really, really liked it. You know, and there were some classic novels I liked, some I didn't. This was absolutely one I liked, but I read it, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen a film version before. And I knew stuff was missing. I had to go back and find out what it was. And that second convict, who's not named in this film version, is called Compeyson. And he is the source of all the troubles in the original story. So Miss Havisham was jilted at the altar by him because he had run a scam with her half-brother to get her to buy something so they could access a fortune. And once she signed that letter, he was gone. Mm. He was the one who got Magwitch into a forgery scheme so that Magwitch ended up in jail. And that first time... in the original crime, and then when they escaped on the moors and were recaptured, he arranged things that he had a better background than Magwitch and always arranged for Magwitch to get the worst punishment. See, and then, of course, he's the antagonist in the climax at the end of the film. So he's a source of a lot of problems, and you don't get any of that.
You don't get any of it. But when it all comes out towards the end, and you've got that scene in the lawyer's office, and he's talking to Pip... The lawyer's talking to Pip.
Jaggers
is talking to Pip and just blurting out all this stuff about the daughter and everything like that. And I thought, this is actually very confusing for someone who actually doesn't know the story.
Yeah.
This could be very confusing. Like, who's what? The daughter? What? What are you? What? Oh, that guy? What? It just can be very confusing. Now, I knew the story, so that was fine.
Mm.
But I thought part of it was even confusing me because I went, this is, no, that's what's happening. But
had you read the book?
No.
Right. So you're not from the Guan film?
Yes, that's right. I thought they could have handled that a bit better.
The woman who was Jagger, the lawyer's maidservant, I think it was Molly.
Yeah.
Was she played by Valerie Hobson, who played Estella? I couldn't find a credit for her.
I don't think so.
I felt like it was her with like some makeup and...
So she played two characters?
I think. I'm not sure about it.
Oh.
Which would make sense in terms of the narrative.
Yeah.
But there was a moment where Miss Havisham was in her chair by the fire... and the adult Estella was sitting next to her on the floor.
Mm.
And it was very artfully constructed because they actually looked like the same woman at different ages.
Yeah, yeah.
In those two different actresses side by side. And there were a number of those visual touches, as well as the kind of the power of the black and white. There were whimsical touches, like the cows that were accusing Pip, the child, at the very beginning.
Yes, that's right.
And calling out to him. And they repeated it when he was an adult, where the ship's figureheads were accusing
him
of stuff.
That's right, yeah.
And I liked the fact that when he came back from running around on the moors as a child, and his older sister, who he doesn't get on with, is calling him back. You can see she's calling Pip. You don't hear her. It's a trombone or some brass instrument that replaces her voice, which makes a nice point. So it's not that it's not a well-told story.
Oh, no, it's very well
done. The story has been a bridge in a way that does it a disservice.
Mm, that's right. So, oh, look, what did you think of Alec Guinness in it?
Well, I described him in my intro as being wide-eyed. His eyes were, like, wide open.
He really is, yeah.
So the stage production, he and Martita Hunt were the only two who were in that and then the film playing the same characters. So he played Herbert Pocket on stage in the version that he had scripted, which David Lean saw before he was a well-known filmmaker, and then they went back to it. I think it was, he saw it in 39, 46, literally either end of World War II. And you can see that Guinness is having a lot of fun playing that character.
Oh, it is a very good character. I mean, it is. It's a great character.
And he, I don't know how old he was at the time, but he does come across as just being very youthful. It's a wellspring within him.
Yeah, much more than John Mills.
John Mills is trying and he's doing earnest thing, but he's too old for the part.
Yeah, he is.
Unfortunately.
There's sometimes when they go, oh, you're 20 now. And I'm like, oh, God, he looks a bit more than 20 there.
Yeah, particularly in some lights.
Yeah, you see a bit of the wrinkle on the...
Exactly. And that's why I went and looked up how old he was because I thought, no, this doesn't feel right.
Now, how old was he when he was
32?
32 when he did that.
Well, maybe 31 when they filmed it, but
yeah. Well, okay. Well, there we go. But look, it wasn't a bad performance by any stretch.
No, I could imagine watching it again.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Not for the story. For some of those moments, I think.
Oh, there's a few really lovely touches there. And, yeah, I like the way he used time. And, you know, when they showed the map, showed the map when he was going to London. But then the horse feet from underneath the carriage were just going constantly within a dissolve with the map. And I thought that's just... You didn't see that at that time. That was just, it's really good vision.
I love some of the sets. And I'm trying to place it historically. So this is 1946 it came out. So it's filmed in 45, 46, I assume. So at the tail end of the war in Britain,
yeah,
when there was a lot of deprivation of food and materials, and the fact that they, the forge was, you know, was nice, but Miss Havisham's house and the garden of the house and the entry point into it, which I'm fairly sure was a set, not a real place.
Yeah.
It was, I think it was built based on the place that Dickens had in mind when he wrote the novel. But it was superb, and I just sat there thinking, my God, how did they do that?
Mm.
I know it's probably all plasterboard and, you know, whatever, but it was
so beautifully done.
And then the transition from the garden, the overgrown garden, into that very dark corridor with the light of the candle and up the staircase and so on. Was just, as a, you know, as I said, it's a masterclass. It was just so impressive.
Estelle is a really interesting character.
I felt she was more successful as the child than the adult, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah. I thought Gene Simmons was appropriately disdainful. You know, about 50-plus years later, she played Miss Havisham.
Did she?
In a 1989. So what's that? Oh, 43 years later. A 1989 telly series. She played Miss Havisham.
Miss Havisham. Cass started watching this a little bit as I was watching it, and the whole scene with Miss Havisham was there, and he was like, she's weird. Oh, she's weird. She's a great character.
Well, apparently in the book, she's only, when you first meet her, when Pip's young, she's only meant to be in her 30s, but any portrayal you see of her, she always looks ancient.
Or the same
cobwebs
age.
Cobwebs and ancient.
That's right. The scene when she catches on fire, it's quite harrowing. Actually, the way they filmed that.
You don't see a lot of it. And I suspect because they didn't have the technology to do special effects for that kind of stuff without endangering the actress. But no, it's very well done.
The scream on the outside of the door.
And him hesitating on the stairs.
That's right. Yeah, it's well done.
I read something somewhere that implied that she had caused the log to fall from the fire that then caught fire for her old dress when she stood up. But I actually thought it was Pip slamming the door, but he had accidentally caused it.
I thought that happened as well.
Yeah,
I thought
I
it was Pip.
It
I definitely thought it was Pip slamming the door.
Yeah,
and then that caused the
dislodged
log
the log
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah,
just another odd thing about the story: Herbert Pocket, he is present at the climax with the boat, where the second convict dies and Magwitch is badly injured.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the trial sentencing scene was very well done, where the camera went along the different people who were all being sentenced en masse and the different reactions they had.
Oh, my goodness. That was, very, very good.
You know, I found it moving.
Yeah, very moving.
But the odd thing was we didn't see Herbert Pocket again. So we saw him at that climax with the ship. He's not in court. He's not with Pip when he goes to visit Magwitch in jail. He's not there when he falls ill. He's not there at the denouement. He just disappears from the story, which felt odd to me.
Is that in the book as well?
No, in the book, Pip makes a recommendation for Herbert's future.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Havisham gives money that he can go out to Egypt in, I think it's a shipping company.
Right.
And in the end, Pip goes out there and makes a success of himself as well. You know, Dickens had two different ends of the story, a romantic and an unromantic one.
Right.
In terms of whether Pip ends up with Estella.
But Havisham dies in the book.
Havisham dies in the book?
Yes, that's right.
Not on the spot. I think she sort of lingers a couple of days, but she dies.
Yeah.
But Pip goes to Egypt and works with Herbert and makes good, you know, but through, you know, hard work and so on.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So Pocket doesn't disappear. It's like, and it's odd because Guinness is playing that character and he wrote the original script for the play.
Yeah, right.
He's just gone. It just felt quite odd.
Mm.
But what are you going to give this?
I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
I'm giving it an 8.
Yep.
I have to say I hovered 7, 8. I think in the end I gave it an 8 just because some of those scenes are just so beautifully done.
They are, but to me I just go, well, they are technically it's beautiful. The way he directed it was beautiful. It's really lovely to watch, and the cinematography and whatnot is really great. And it's beautiful to now be able to watch it with restored versions rather than just a VHS copy, which has been around for years and years. So it's actually really nice to watch clear versions of these films.
Yeah.
And that's what you can really notice the beautiful work that was put into those movies. But again, it didn't move me much.
Yeah,
I wasn't moved.
For me, actually, it was more 7.5. I was really kind of between the two.
Yeah.
So I'm going to change my score. It's 7.5.
7.5, yeah. Okay.
Now, before we move on to our next film, the musical, Great Expectations.
Oh, yeah, good, please.
I have some song titles.
Please. Yes, go for it.
So unsurprisingly, one of the songs is called Great Expectations.
Yeah.
There's another song whose title these days is a bit more worrying. It's called All Little Boys Should Be Grateful. But my favourite from the soundtrack, I actually tried to find a copy of this song to listen to, and you can only apparently get to it through Apple Music.
Great expectations.
Now, this song is called Cobwebs and Cake. I would love to hear Cobwebs and Cake.
What would that be? Cobwebs and Cake?
No. It'd be moody. It would be her. It'd be her great lament for the love that she lost.
That's
and,
right.
And then falling into this, you know, decrepit world of cobwebs and cake. I reckon it's a kind of
how would it go?
I reckon it would be like the main female character from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Sunset Boulevard.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I reckon it'd be that style.
Yeah.
So, Ricardo, for our third film, you're going to tell us about Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Hey, you're funny.
Well, I'd rather watch that. Oh, what a giveaway.
Hey, listen. Rocky.
Horror Picture Show.
Written and starring Sylvester Stallone and directed by John G. Avildsen, this 1976 film centres around the title character of Rocky Balboa, a struggling boxer trying to make it in that sport while working as a debt collector for a living. He's not the brightest, but has a lot of heart and talent. When heavyweight champion Apollo Creed, Carl Weathers, visits Philadelphia, he sets up an exhibition match to give an up-and-coming boxer a go, touting the fight as a chance for a nobody to become a somebody. He chooses Rocky Balboa, the Italian Stallion. While training with feisty Mickey Goldmill, Burgess Meredith in his iconic role, Rocky also tentatively begins a relationship with Adrian, Talia Shire, who works in a pet store and is the sister to Rocky's friend Paulie, a meatpacker and a temperamental alcoholic. The relationship between Adrian and Rocky is so sweet and lovely, and Talia Shire is just wonderful in the role. Now, the end boxing match is supposed to be easily won by Creed, who says he'll knock him out in 3 rounds, but someone forgot to tell Rocky, who sees this as his only shot to really prove himself. He's not concerned about winning, just going the distance with Creed to prove he's not just another bum from the neighbourhood. Stallone is said to have written the first draft of this film in 4 days. He demanded he play the title role when he got interest, but he was also offered $350,000 for the screenplay with him not playing Rocky. He turned that down. And he was a nobody at the time with only a few credits to his name. He persisted and got his chance. The budget was only $1 million and he was only paid the very minimum weekly wage to act in it. Now, it was a really sleeper hit on release, but it has now since become iconic. The scenes of him punching the meat, drinking raw eggs, and running up the Philadelphia steps that are now named as the Rocky Steps have become a part of movie history. It was nominated for 10 Academy Awards, winning 3 for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Editing. Of course, Stallone went on to become a megastar. He wrote every Rocky film after and also directed the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 6th installments. What a huge talent. Now, as you know, Greg, I just love this film. And actually, you know, I love the entire Rocky franchise.
Really? You surprise right? me.
But this one's the best. Forgetting about the boxing parts for a minute, this really is just about somebody daring to dream, to struggle and come from nothing, to give their all and to prove that they can do something. And as I said, it's not about winning. It's about knowing you gave it your best shot. Happiness is that place. There are never any regrets when you've given your all, no matter what happens. So this film is so raw, yet has so much heart. I just love it. Greg, I want to know your thoughts.
Yeah, what you said. I don't want to treadle over your dreams.
No, what are you thinking?
Let's name the elephant in the studio, right?
No, what's that? Yeah.
And that is, you want to know, has the film changed my mind in my opinion that I don't think Sylvester Stallone can act?
No, not even that. I just want to know whether you enjoyed the film.
Because you remember,
I do remember that we reviewed
Cliffhanger
some time ago.
You did. And I said to you, this man cannot act.
Yeah, you did.
So when you suggested Rocky, I was thinking, oh, sigh. I should have chosen Brief Encounter. Anyway, well, no. Sorry. I agree with one thing you said wholeheartedly. I think Talia Shire is luminous in this. Mm. She's fantastic. She's a bit too quiet at the start. But then as her character blossoms, she's fantastic.
Yeah, she is.
I think she is far and away the best thing in the film.
I think that's a beautiful build, though.
Yeah. And the other one that I liked in this, although they didn't have a lot to do, was Carl Weathers, who plays Apollo Creed.
Oh, he's great.
The first time you see him, I think it's in his office, and he's saying, this other guy's cancelled on me. It's the bicentennial year for America. We need something. And he says, I've got this idea, you know, and nobody gets his one shot at the heavyweight title.
That's right.
And he picks Rocky on his nickname, the Italian Stallion. His appearance in that scene was very, very short. And there were a few more of those until the big fight scene.
Yeah.
But in that scene, I thought, wow, who is this guy? Because I didn't know him. So for me, in terms of acting, they're the ones that stand out for me. Mm. I was looking forward to Burgess Meredith. Burgess Meredith, for me, will always be the Penguin in TV's Batman.
I know
he's got a much more illustrious career than this. But I have to say, I found him very one-note in this.
Yeah.
I was expecting more light and shade.
Well, actually, you actually see a bit more light and shade in the next installments. He's in number 1, 2, and 3, and he makes a brief appearance in a
flashback
in Rocky V, which is actually a beautiful scene. So there is a lot more light and shade.
Yeah, and it wasn't there. And I actually thought that would be one of the parts of the film that I would look forward to.
Well, there's that moment when he actually comes back and wants to train him. And that's an amazing scene.
Well, no, because I thought he was having a shot at his own redemption.
Of course he was, yes.
But it didn't gel for me. And in fact, I was quite surprised. So Sylvester Stallone, I think, was nominated for Best Actor that year.
Yes.
Kaya Shire was nominated for Best
Screenplay as well. Best screenplay.
And Director? Best Picture, certainly.
Well, John Jefferson won Best Director.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Taya Shire was nominated for Best Actress or Supporting Actress.
Actress. Yeah.
And both Burgess Meredith and the Paulie character, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name for the moment, they were both nominated for Best Supporting Actor and could have, you know, if you'll pardon the pun, knocked each other out of the ring because they're both from the same film. But Paulie had a bit more to do, but I was watching his performance thinking, Best Supporting Actor, really? I'm not feeling it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's my best description of the whole thing, that I wasn't feeling it. Maybe if I'd known before I watched it, that the budget, which was $1.1 million, and then they spent about, I think it was about another $450,000 or something on the marketing, but the budget of the film was really tight.
It was very tight.
And maybe I would have been a bit more kindly in watching it if I'd known that up front. Mm. A bit like you argued earlier in this series for Once.
Yeah, that's
you know, I didn't like much.
Well, you know, the ice skating rink scene.
Yes, I know why it was done that way. Yeah, they couldn't afford the extras.
They couldn't, no. It was all budgetary. Yeah.
And there's that scene where he's had the fight with Spider Rico, the boxer in the first match, and he's going home. I have to say, I got a bit tired very quickly of his kind of rollicking walk that was meant to be character, I think. Have you noticed that?
It's just Rocky.
No, for me, it was a bit overmannered. But anyway, and he walks down the street and he encounters different people and he goes past that group of guys singing on the corner.
That's right, take it back.
And says, you're getting better all the time. Right, and I was looking, thinking, why is that here? Mm. And in fact, there were a few times where things happen and I was waiting for the payoff. But the reason for that scene is because his brother's in the singing group, in the same way that their father played the timekeeper in the boxing match.
That's right.
So drew on family, low budget, totally get it, great. But I kind of thought, what's that really doing here? It felt, and this is why I felt it was too slow in getting to the real narrative.
I think it needs that build. It really needs a good build up.
I think you could have made that tighter. I agree for the need for the build, but I think it would have been tighter. But then there's all that stuff about him being the kind-hearted, not terribly bright debt collector for Gazzo. And I kept waiting for that relationship to pay off in the story. I thought what was going to happen was that Gazzo was going to try and fix the fight.
Mm-hmm.
That there would be some kind, or at least put pressure on him, that would bring the circularity around.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, again, like that was a part of the story. It's like, yeah, okay, but I was expecting more from that.
Oh, look, it doesn't get into the whole gangster side of it. And he's really just a secondary character. I mean, really, he just stops. He stops debt collecting.
Yeah.
It doesn't really come back to us, so it doesn't really pay it off.
No.
And you see him at the end. But
there shouldn't be some sort of moral dictum that says all story elements must pay off.
No.
But I felt the lack of that.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And here's my problem with Sylvester Stallone, and it's unchanged from Cliffhanger. When I watch him, I feel like I'm watching someone who's acting rather than someone who's actually being that character.
I can see sometimes in some films, but not this. This here, he's so raw.
There was one scene.
He's so subtle in this.
Now, there was one scene where I thought it really worked. There was one standout scene for me.
I think every scene works. Let me just tell you. Every scene.
You know we're not going to agree on this,
yes,
right?
Yes, I know. Okay. I know.
I thought the standout scene was Rocky and Adrian, their first night together. Kind of the seduction scene. The very clumsy seduction, but which morphs into him putting his arm around her and her kind of just falling into that hug as they both slide to the floor. Almost in a beautifully graceful, choreographed kind of way. For me, that moment absolutely worked with both of them.
Mm.
And for me, that was the moment in the film. Not the fight or anything about the fight.
No, no. But I love a lot of moments in the film, but I think the moment when he is questioning whether he can do it or not, and he goes to the stadium and looks at the
poster.
Looks at the poster and sees that it's the wrong shorts.
And you know that was an actual mistake?
It was a mistake, that's right, yeah. But that moment when he goes back and questions himself before he does the fight is just beautiful. When he says he doesn't want to be another bum from the neighbourhood. Look, the Rocky films hit me in a way. I really connect with them and I connect with him in a way where just I just get very emotional over these films. And like I said, it's not about winning. And again, I think the message is not really about boxing. People say it's a sporting film. But to me, this is Stallone's Rocky. I mean, it's his life of getting the film up.
I totally agree with that. And I think that's one of the reasons it did so well in its time.
But
he was the epitome of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
the story was a parallel about what was happening for him.
Absolutely.
And Hollywood loves that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they do. And kudos to him for that. I mean, at that stage, to be offered such an amount, to be not in it, but just to stand your ground when you really don't have much, because it's not about the money. It's about what you're feeling inside, what you can do. And having belief in that.
But are you now relating to the film or Sylvester Stallone?
Oh, I'm relating to that story of how he got it up, absolutely. But I think that completely mirrors the film.
Well, look, you know that sport films are not my go-to genre.
That's right.
With rare exceptions, very rare exceptions, and you know one of those is Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's number one, it's tempting the guy out of my head. But normally, I get that sports films are a vehicle for other stories. So, you know, Field of Dreams is about fathers and sons.
Yeah, that's right.
And lost opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Rocky is about the story of Sylvester Stallone. You know, the guy who's not gone very well in his field and suddenly this one shot comes out of nowhere and he clings to it. I get it. I didn't feel it.
Wow.
The only other bit that I felt, apart from that moment when they collapsed into that embrace, was when they cut his eyelid.
Yeah, during sports. Absolutely. Yeah,
now, I'd say the blood there looked really fake, like too gloopy or something. Mm. But even so, I shrank inward.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that happened.
Yeah, you know Apollo Creed is bottled off Muhammad Ali.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And when Joe Frazier, they called Joe Frazier into the ring, who's a champion.
Like, and was a major opponent of Muhammad Ali. Yep.
Oh, those fights are the best fights. You know, people talk about the George Foreman rumble in the jungle with Muhammad Ali. To me, that was a bit of a boring fight until the end. I mean, Muhammad Ali was on the ropes most of the match, and then tired out George Foreman, and then came out fighting. And so, but whereas the Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali fights, where you know Joe Frazier won one, Muhammad Ali won another, they are brutal. They are brutal encounters.
This is part of my problem, and I felt it when I was watching the film.
Yeah.
Boxing as a sport,
yeah.
I am antithetical to. Now, I couldn't be more uninterested. I find it violent. I think the idea of having a sport which is about beating up your opponent, that was very clear in this film.
Yeah, but there's a lot of technique in this. Technique
with a golf club, a baseball bat, in the pool,
I understand
a football.
But it's been,
I get that.
It's
I don't feel it, but I get it.
Yeah.
But fighting...
Okay. Yeah, no, I disagree. I think the sport is a great sport. I don't like MMA, a lot of the mixed martial arts ones, because I find that gets a bit too street fighty and the technique goes out the window. You know, I'm not into knocking somebody on the ground and then going at them with a hammer punch while they're knocked out. I just think that's wrong and I just think it looks ugly. So I'm not a massive fan of MMA for that reason. But boxing has so much technique and skill that...
But exercise in a way that I'm so uncomfortable with.
Of course, because, you know... But
I actually preferred the boxing scenes in Great Expectations.
Oh. Not a patch.
They were comic.
But look, as the series goes on for Rocky, and I'm not sure whether you'll watch the rest of the series.
Well, you know, because you persuaded me on the Scream series, I ended up watching all four
you
Scream
did.
Films.
Yeah, you did.
And I thought, is it just this? And so I actually read the plot outlines of the subsequent Rocky films. I thought, yeah. Not interested.
Well, the second one you might want to see more than the third, fourth, and fifth, and so on. And the second one is a direct follow-on.
Yes, I know.
From
I read the plot outline. Right?
Okay, so it's actually a really good story there. And I think you might like that, actually. I think you might get a lot out of that. The third one, it sort of tends to go very 80s and you know, but you're following his rise, though. You're following Rocky's rise through it. So I don't look at the Rocky as, you know, just one film. It's a journey.
It's an arc.
Yeah, right. And so the first one is an amazing film on its own right. But then the second one, again, is, you know, I sort of go between what's better, the second one or the first one. And I always go the first is the best. But the second one, it sort of nears it sometimes. I just love the second. The third one is my least favourite, but it's still very good. But it's at his height and, you know, he earns a lot of money and whatnot. Number four is just, like, people call it a bit ludicrous, but it's one of the most enjoyable Rockies. It came out in 1984 in the middle of the Cold War.
Yep.
And it's Russia versus America.
Is that Dolph Lundgren?
Yep. That's right. And so, but geez, it's enjoyable. And, you know, Sylvester Stallone currently is has just finished editing the director's cut of Rocky IV and has put extra scenes in there and taken some out, which he didn't like. And so he's just done a recut of Rocky IV, which I cannot wait to see. I follow him on Instagram and he's wonderful in what he's doing. Number five was interesting because number five, it was meant to be the end of the series. They got John G. Avildsen to direct again for the, you know, through the first and the last. And he got his son, his late son now, Sage Stallone, to act with him in the film. And he's actually very good in the film, Sage. And look, people dislike Rocky V a lot. One of the main reasons why is that I think he was meant to die at the end of that movie, Rocky, and he was written to die. And I think the whole film, you know, after the effects of the fight of number four, he comes out in number five and, you know, he's got these issues with his brain, and if he gets into another fight, he could die.
Yep.
So he starts training somebody else. Now, that whole story is great if he's going to die, but the studio made a decision to not kill off that character, and it sort of doesn't work. You go,
well, they'd be looking at the franchise.
Yeah, that's right. It's another one you might want to go to as well, because it actually is beautiful as well, is Rocky Balboa, the sixth. You might want to just go to the second and then the sixth, you know, because
I might not.
No, I'd like you to. Number six, he was, yeah, people were laughing at the thought of another Rocky after five, and he brought this out, I think it was 2006 or seven, and it's really good. He didn't get that much money to do it, but it's really, really good. But then obviously he's made he got a nomination again for Rocky on Creed.
Hmm.
But no, it's a really good franchise and one I love, you know.
And you know, I respect your passion. I genuinely do. I don't feel it myself, but I respect it. But it's not a film or, you know, a genre, particularly boxing, that speaks to me.
Yeah, well, if that doesn't, it's really difficult. I mean, look, my dad was a boxer.
Oh, okay.
You know, so dad, you know, had a few professional fights and whatnot, and then developed, you know, tennis elbow in his elbow and then had to leave boxing. But he boxed for quite a few years. And so I grew up with dad being a boxer and the photos of dad being a boxer.
Yeah.
And then I studied a bit of boxing. So I knew all about, you know, the Sonny Liston and Joe Frazier, dad, all the boxing mags, which were there from the time. And I used to read up on them and I used to love it. You know, it was a great...
So our disagreement about this film is going to stay purely conversational, not fisticuffs, right?
Fisticuffs. Let's go.
No.
Ding, no, ding.
No, not going to happen. Hey, just one other thing about this film before we talk about scores and so on.
Yeah.
One thing that I reckon has changed in my viewing of films as a result of this podcast, it was kind of instinctive, but now it's almost something I deliberately do, is I focus on the opening and closing shots of a film. You know, how is the director trying to establish this film, maybe the themes of the film?
Yeah.
How are they tying it off? Is it well done? Is it tokenistic? I found the end of Great Expectations tokenistic.
That Hollywood.
Suddenly everything's fine. They go off together.
When the rest of the movie wasn't actually.
No.
So it was
it
when
stuck
was like,
out.
Suddenly they're holding hands out to the sunset. Dun, dun, dun. And I just went, oh, yeah. Okay.
So the closing shot of Rocky is
the freeze frame.
Yep, yep. And I, by the way, I certainly do agree with you about the, you know, the iconic nature of the Rocky steps and the music, you know, Gonna Fly Now and so on. Totally get that.
Oh, it's a great. I didn't even mention the score.
But the opening shot.
Yeah, iconic score, sorry.
The opening shot of Rocky, what is it? It's Jesus.
Yes, it is.
It's Jesus.
Yes, sorry.
It's Jesus who gave his life for the world. Has the Alpha and Omega either side at the beginning
and
the end.
Yes, of course.
Holding,
he's fighting Spider Rico.
Holding, I think, the Cup of Salvation.
Yes.
Real tight close-up, and then it pans out, and you see the first fight he's having with Spider.
Yeah, which is quite an ugly-looking fight. Really bad trunks, yeah.
But I just sat there for the first parts of the film thinking, why have you started with that? Is there meant to be some sort of deeper message here? And maybe, you know, I'm overanalyzing it. It's completely possible. Or was it just something about the culture that they're Italian Catholic? It was just like a weird opening shot. I didn't know what to make of it.
Okay.
But anyway, so what's this view out of 10? 25?
I'm giving it a 10. I love it a lot. I think it's a great film. I'm giving it a 10.
And are you going to hazard a guess as to my score?
Oh, look, you know, 6?
Yeah, spot on. It's 6.
Is it 6?
It's
okay,
a 6.
There we go. Yeah.
Look, I didn't hate it. I'm not a fan of Stallone. I'm sorry. Certainly as an actor. And I said, I just felt it was too slow to get going. But there were parts, and I was disappointed in Burgess Meredith. There was parts I did like. And every time Talia Shire was on screen, I just watched her. I just thought she was terrific.
Amazing. She was the last sort of to be cast as well in that role. And I feel like she's, you know, in her career with the Godfather as well.
Which she'd done before this.
She did before that. She's amazing in The Godfathers. She fought for that role as well because she was obviously Coppola's sister.
Yep.
And she fought for that role. But this one here, she was the last to think. But she's such an amazing actor. I love her in anything she does.
I can't remember her in The Godfather. Mm. But yeah, look, she's the standout in this for me. Now, so that's my score. The musical of Rocky.
Oh, goodness me. You know what? I was just going to say, when I heard there was a musical of Rocky, I did not even think to see it. I'm not a massive fan of
musicals.
You
didn't have a chance, did you?
But no, I didn't. I did because it was only in New York. But yeah. I was just like, oh, just to hear someone singing a song, I couldn't do it.
Well, let me tell you the titles of some of the songs that got my attention.
Yeah, go for it.
Training Montage number 1.
Yep.
Training Montage number 2. And the title that I like even more than Cobwebs and Cake, My Nose Ain't Broken.
So that concludes episode 7 of season 4 for the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast, the Greg in the Confessional episode.
And I want you to know I feel thoroughly cleansed.
Well, you know what? I'm actually, even though you gave Rocky a 6 out of 10, I actually like that you can appreciate it and that
that means.
You give it a 2 out of 10.
It means I think it's twice as good as Cabaret.
Yeah. We'll always have Cabaret.
We'll always have Cabaret. So next time, Ricardo, next time we're going to do an episode called Spook for Yourself.
Oh, it's going to be a wonderful one. This one, I can't wait.
It'll be a change of pace.
Yeah, so what we're looking at is 3 ghost stories, which are across different genres. So the first film we're going to look at is Poltergeist 2 from 1986. Poltergeist 2, The Other Side.
That's good, the correct title.
Yes.
And then we're going to do a film that's currently streaming on Amazon Prime, at least in Australia, an Irish film from 2019 called Extraordinary. It's a comedy ghost story I've seen and I like that you've yet to see.
I'm yet to see it, yeah. And then we're going to look at 2017's A Ghost Story, which is a drama, fantasy, romance. So 3 differing genres across a ghost story.
Spooky, funny, and drama.
Drama, romance. Yeah, so it's going to be really interesting. I can't wait to see these films, actually. I'm really looking forward to them.
So we'll spook to you soon.
That's right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And, we're looking forward to next time.